Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Axel Grothy for his take on what's new and interesting in colorectal cancer and also pancreatic and gastric neoplasia. And to begin, Dr. Grothy commented on recent data sets in colorectal cancer, beginning with a major report at ASCO on the use of EGFR antibody treatment in the adjuvant colon cancer setting.
This was a large intergroup endeavor, a phase 3 trial adjuvant therapy in stage 3 colon cancer, modified FOLFOX6 with or without cetuximab. This trial was started about 7 years ago, and at that time, no one talked about KRAS. So we had a group of patients in this trial which had KRAS mutant tumors, which were enrolled to a cetuximab regimen. So in the end, the primary endpoint was adjusted to the trial to look at FOLFOX plus minus cetuximab in KRAS wild-type tumors. But we had cohorts KRAS wild-type, KRAS mutant tumors. And so when I saw the data of this trial, I actually was really shocked because I had thought, we had our HER2 in breast cancer. We had our KRAS-enriched population. We had a drug like cetuximab, which had clear activity, a single agent and in combination with chemotherapy in colon cancer. We knew the population to treat, and this should work in adjuvant therapy, and it failed miserably. Because neither in the KRAS wild-type nor in the KRAS mutant tumors did we see any benefit. If at all, there was some detrimental effect. These disease-free survival and overall survival curves with the addition of cetuximab to FOLFOX trailed below the actual FOLFOX therapy. This detrimental effect was very much pronounced in, number one, elderly patients and in KRAS mutant tumors. So elderly patients, mainly also because we probably compromised dose intensity over time because the addition of cetuximab to FOLFOX was clearly more toxic. No question about that. And in KRAS mutant tumors, we have seen a lot more evidence recently in metastatic disease, even that the addition of cetuximab to an oxaliplatin-based regimen in KRAS mutant tumors does something wrong. It interferes with activity. It takes away the activity of the underlying chemotherapy. We've seen these effects in OPUS, in the FOLFOX plus minus cetuximab palliative therapy, in PRIME, FOLFOX plus minus panitumumab first-line therapy. There's something going on in KRAS mutant tumors with the interaction of 5-FU-oxaliplatin plus EGF receptor antibodies. So in the end, this was very disturbing, actually, and very disappointing. It's kind of lined up a sequence of failed phase 3 trials in adjuvant setting in the sense that, we've tested irinotecan and we've tested bevacizumab, we've tested cetuximab. All these drugs work in a palliative setting, but they fail in adjuvant setting. The only drug that worked in both ways was oxaliplatin recently. And now the question is, where do we go from here? How can we ever develop novel agents, new strategies in the adjuvant setting? What is this agent or whatever treatment we were looking at need to fulfill in terms of criteria before we move into adjuvant therapy? I think we're pretty much at a loss right now.
Yeah, that's not good. But speaking of adjuvant therapy, you've had a lot of interest in the issue of stage 2 disease. And there was a presentation at ASCO by Mike O'Connell from the NSABP, which I sure would appreciate if you could explain to me because it was challenging, looking at molecular and pathologic features of stage 2 and 3 colon cancer. This is the Oncotype one.
Yeah, the Oncotype. There's a long and ongoing debate whether or not stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer are really the same biologic disease. When we talk about stage 3, these tumors have apparently been able to generate lymph node metastasis of high risk of recurrence, lower overall survival. Stage 2 disease, is it just kind of a step on the way to stage 3, or is it a distinct biologic entity? So there are arguments pros and cons because the PETAC-3 trial, which you mentioned before, the adjuvant FOLFIRI trial, actually presented data at ASCO 2009 where they showed very distinct molecular parameters and alterations of gene profiles between stage 2 and stage 3. For instance, the incidence of MSI tumors is higher in stage 2 than stage 3. There are certain other molecular alterations regarding P53 and STAT pathway, which are different between stage 2 and stage 3. So Mike O'Connell now used the Oncotype DX platform, which is a commercially available test to get some prognostic implication for stage 2 colon cancers. And he looked at the data they had when they looked at the NSABP trials of this gene expression test and gene expression profile of, and as far as I can recall, about 360 markers, different markers assessed by RT-PCR, meaning kind of mRNA expression levels. And they found a high concordance between stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancers in their analysis. So this could imply that there is really not a lot of difference between these tumors biologically in terms of their genetic makeup and their molecular expression patterns. The problem that I have with this analysis is, number one, I mean, we have more than 380 genes. I mean, there is a lot more genes that could kind of be responsible for differences in biology between stage 2 and stage 3. And even if only just 5 genes were different, which they were, I mean, actually more than 5 genes, you know, one gene alone can drive a different biology. We know that from HER2 in breast cancer. We know that from, let's say, KRAS and BRAF in colon cancer. So I'm not quite satisfied with just looking at a subset of genetic markers and saying, you know, we see a high concordance here, and so these tumors are not different. Clinically, they do behave differently, and I would leave it up for a future analysis, kind of a genome-wide analysis, to really see whether there is a high concordance or not between these tumors.
Now, just to clarify, you refer to this as, quote, commercially available, but am I correct in saying that the colon oncotype is not commercially available, just the breast one?
It is available. It's available since ASCO GI, actually. They made it available.
Wow.
And it's, as far as I heard, the pickup is actually faster than the Oncotype DX breast cancer.
That's interesting, because I remember when Oncotype breast was first presented, it was very slow. You know, the whole concept was so new. Like the first year, almost nobody used it.
Yep.
So it's interesting. I think now that people have had that experience with breast, that they're kind of maybe responding more quickly to the colon one. Are you using it yourself?
No, we're not using it actively. I mean, if patients ask for it, I mean, there are a lot of patients who come with preformed opinions what needs to be done nowadays with more information on the internet, etc. We have mechanisms to make it happen. You know, we send it out to the company. The problem that I see with the Oncotype DX colon cancer test is, in contrast to the breast cancer, it's not predictive, it's just prognostic. And even the prognostic discrimination between these different low, medium, high risk group is not as strong as in breast cancer. So overall, it's a weaker test than the breast cancer test. And I think Genomic Health acknowledges that. The problem that I have with this analysis, the QUASAR analysis, is that, you know, in QUASAR, more than 60% of patients did not have adequate lymph node dissection or adequate lymph node information. They had less than 10, 12 lymph nodes available. So I think there is a lot of contamination from stage 3 patients, potentially in this group of patients, which can definitely influence anything we see in terms of risk discrimination between when you use this Oncotype DX test. So the good news is they're still working on refining the test. I mean, nowadays we use, for a lot of patients, with oxaliplatin-based regimens. So they're actually working with the investigators from Mosaic and CO7 to now kind of develop another molecular marker test for the more modern therapy.
Anything new in terms of management of stage 2 disease?
You know, I think what we've learned in the last year is we have clarified better high and low risk groups to some extent. We have seen that patient with T4 disease, for instance, T4A and T4B have a poor prognosis. And in my clinical practice, I think we're treating them very similar to stage 3 patients. I mean, we've talked about this before. This is clearly a high-risk group of patients. Number two, I think we have really made sure, and this is, I think, nowadays standard of care, that MSI-high tumors in stage 2, or the so-called defective mismatch repair tumors, they should not receive any adjuvant therapy because the outcome is so excellent. In fact, we're eliminating about 15% of patients from therapy, which, considering how many patients with stage 2 disease we have, is actually a substantial number. So for my purpose, if there is a patient with stage 2 disease, absence of high risk factors, mainly T4, and is a patient where you consider adjuvant therapy, this patient should be tested and has to be tested for MSI. And if it's an MSI-high tumor or a DMMR tumor, this patient should not receive adjuvant chemotherapy.
One more ASCO paper was the presentation by Deborah Schrag looking at neoadjuvant FOLFOX-BEV without radiation therapy for locally advanced rectal cancer.
Very interesting aspect. You know, when we look at the treatment of rectal cancer, I'm not talking about metastatic, but localized rectal cancer, our standard of care nowadays is for most patients using a neoadjuvant radiochemotherapy approach. And I think all of us acknowledge that the radiation component is probably the more toxic component of this treatment, particularly with long-term side effects. I mean, I have patients who have these radiation proctitis, which are really nasty, which lead to pain, constant diarrhea, sphincter dysfunction. So an idea in terms of a paradigm shift would be to use highly systemically active and locally active systemic chemotherapy to see whether we can get away without radiation therapy. And Memorial Sloan Kettering had a very interesting kind of pilot study, actually two pilot studies, one FOLFOX with bevacizumab and one FOLFOX without bevacizumab. And they showed that systemic treatment can actually generate significant responses in primary tumors in the rectum. They actually had in their series a single institution setting, high-end cancer center, but they had a more than 30% PathCR rate in these patients, rectal cancer patients who had mid or higher rectum adenocarcinomas without radiation therapy, which is probably as good as it gets when you talk about 5-FU-based neoadjuvant radiation chemotherapy. It's very comparable to that. So I think this is actually a very interesting strategy which should be explored. And I know that ACOSOC and CLGB, both cooperative groups, actually have proposals in their portfolio right now to test this prospectively in a multi-center setting with a surgical quality assurance, etc. Because, I mean, you know, it would be very helpful for our patients if we could get rid of radiation therapy, at least for the mid to high rectum cancer.
I know I first heard about this from Len Saltz a few months ago, and I got to say, I mean, it sounds a little scary not using radiation therapy in rectal cancer in terms of, you know, our fears of getting out of control of local problems.
Yeah, you know, but the data they showed are quite convincing. When you look at, they documented these cases very well. The critical issue is, and this raises one of the main points right now in rectal cancer, is adequate imaging before you treat these patients. I mean, you really have to make sure that you identify the patient population that's eligible for that, and that's a good candidate. You don't want T4 tumors. I mean, you really want to have those patients with, let's say, T3N0, perhaps T3N1, but definitely not more than that. I mean, but that's the bulk of patients. So you don't want patients in this setting, and I would share your concerns, if you, let's say, are not quite sure about the lymph node status. I mean, you need to make sure that these patients are potentially resectable, clearly resectable, and you don't need any radiochemotherapy to downstage them. So I think it is interesting for patients over time that we reduce the morbidity of our treatment, long-term morbidity, but we have to have safeguards in place.
So how about this Spanish trial presented by Joseph Tabernero at ASCO on patients with colorectal cancer and advanced disease receiving Xelox Bev up front and comparing continuation of both to just the Bev?
It's an interesting study by design with some flaws, which I think Alan Vanook pointed out very well in his discussion. So the idea behind this trial is that a question is lingering whether bevacizumab could be a relevant and active maintenance therapy, a single agent, after induction therapy with a combination of chemotherapy and bevacizumab. So this trial was a Spanish trial, a Spanish cooperative group trial. 480 patients were randomized to 6 cycles of capecitabine, oxaliplatin, and bevacizumab. And then patients were either continued in bevacizumab as maintenance therapy, or they continued on Xelox, capecitabine, oxaliplatin, and bevacizumab. And this, by definition, is a non-inferiority design. And in a 480-patient trial, I mean, to make this a non-inferiority statistical design, the investigators had to be very generous with their margins of error, which they allowed.
So really, the question they were asking was, everybody had Bev continued, but half of them also had the Xelox continued.
That actually was a problem by itself, because continuation of oxaliplatin beyond, let's say, these 6 cycles of 130 milligrams per meter squared led to 25% of patients having grade 3-4 neurotoxicity, which I think is unacceptable. I mean, a better design for me would have been to compare, let's say, capecitabine bevacizumab versus a control arm of no treatment. And actually, this trial is ongoing right now. It's a German trial. There's at least one area where Germany beats Spain, you know, in terms of clinical trial designs, even if the World Cup wasn't as successful.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
So that shouldn't bias my opinion about the Spanish TDD trial. But the absence of a control arm, the continuation of oxaliplatin, I think these are really flaws which hamper and impair our interpretation of this data. So for our clinical practice, bevacizumab single-agent therapy should not be used as a maintenance therapy.
How do you approach these patients off study in terms of whether you continue treatment or what you continue?
So my default for patients when I have a clear palliative scenario, and we're not talking about liver resection, metastasectomy, whatever, is to, when I start with an oxaliplatin-based regimen, to use either FOLFOX or Zelox and stop after either 8 cycles of FOLFOX or 6 cycles of Zelox, stop the oxaliplatin component, and continue the fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab as maintenance therapy. I think this is my treatment to progression approach, which I use as a default for most of my patients.
There was another presentation from the so-called COIN trial looking at patients in terms of whether they responded to cetuximab in addition to oxalifluoropyrimidine as first-line therapy. What did that show?
You know, the COIN trial was one of the largest trials ever conducted in first-line colorectal cancer. It was kind of a very pragmatic UK-like approach. You had three different treatment groups. One was FOLFOX, the other was FOLFOX cetuximab. Then one arm you looked at a stop-and-go strategy with complete chemotherapy for intervals. And I think the interesting results actually came from the FOLFOX plus minus cetuximab comparison in KRAS wild-type tumors, because this is probably the only trial we've seen so far that really didn't show any benefit in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival for the addition of cetuximab. These curves were completely superimposable. So several things to that. Number one, there was an increase in response rate, so there was some sign of activity. Number two, they did an interesting analysis in terms of what kind of chemotherapy backbone they combined cetuximab with, because in the UK, 2/3 of physicians actually opted to use Zelox, capecitabine, and oxaliplatin as their chemotherapy backbone and not FOLFOX. And apparently in their analysis, there was some negative interaction between the capecitabine, oxaliplatin, and cetuximab combination, potentially with a higher incidence of skin rash, you know, toxicities, diarrhea. And so the dose intensity was presumably not as high in this capecitabine oxaliplatin cetuximab combination compared to FOLFOX cetuximab. So when they looked at it, when they broke this down, they actually showed that there was some increase in progression-free survival in patients added cetuximab to FOLFOX, but not when they added cetuximab to capecitabine oxaliplatin. So, you know, overall, we're still puzzled by COIN, and I would not think that this kind of reflects what we're doing here in standard of care and how we should perceive the addition of cetuximab to an oxaliplatin-based regimen, because I think we have more data coming from PRIME, for instance, the FOLFOX plus minus panitumumab phase 3 trial first line, and from the OPUS trial, that the addition of cetuximab and panitumumab to oxaliplatin-based regimen actually works in KRAS wild-type tumors.
So let's talk about your cases. And I got to ask you first, because this has been a tremendous interest to a lot of people, including me, since last year, about your 64-year-old man with the HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer.
It's pretty interesting. I mean, this case was, for me, one of the most dramatic responses I've actually seen in my life in terms of metastatic gastric or GE junction cancer. And I think, you know, this has really emphasized to me the importance of having these tumors tested for HER2 overexpression. So the background is, as you alluded to, that nowadays, based on phase 3 data, we actually use trastuzumab in these patients with HER2 overexpressing gastric and GE junction adenocarcinomas. And the patient case that I had was a 64-year-old patient who came from Virginia, was actually in the process of moving to Minnesota because of his children who live in the Twin Cities. He had developed dysphagia in December of 2009, and an EGD showed a large mass at the GE junction, biopsies confirmed adenocarcinoma, and the CT scan then revealed large intrahepatic metastases. And these metastases were really kind of very easily visible. I mean, really mainly in the right lobe, but also left lobe.
Yeah, this slide of the CAT scan is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was in January of 2010 when he came to Mayo Clinic. And I sat down with him and we talked about the palliative nature of his disease. I mean, the goal of any treatment was to extend the duration of his life, maintain quality of his life. And one of our standard treatments is EOX, which is epirubicin, oxaliplatin, and capecitabine, based on the REAL-2 data from David Cunningham. There's always a discussion, do you really need epirubicin or not? I mean, we can argue about this, but it is actually a pretty well-tolerated regimen and quite effective. But parallel to initiating the chemotherapy, because I didn't want to wait too long, this patient had a large tumor burden in his liver, we initiated HER2 testing, which in our institution is immunohistochemistry first, and if we have an IHC2+ result, we do FISH, very similar to kind of a breast cancer algorithm.
Just to pick up on that a little bit, are there any issues in terms of, you know, doing the test? And I've heard from Eric Van Cutsem and others, you know, in terms of sort of the pathology of this disease and whether it's homogeneous, or is it just sort of like breast cancer?
No, it's not like breast cancer. I mean, there's a lot more tumor heterogeneity in between areas of one tumor specimen. And actually, when we talked about it, kind of tried to have a consensus conference with pathologists and gastroenterologists, pathologists actually want 4 biopsies, you know, at least 4 biopsies, and screen every one of them, because there's a heterogeneity within this tumor material between anything from IHC 1 plus to 3 plus. So if you get the wrong area, you might not really pick up 3 plus areas. And the second point is the scoring system is not perfectly aligned with the breast cancer scoring system. So you use the same staining kit, for instance, the DARCO test as a pathologist, but whether or not you call it a 3+ or a 2+ differs between breast cancer categories and gastric and GE junction categories. Then we know, for instance, HER2 overexpression is much more common in intestinal cancers compared to diffuse cancers. So it's actually something we're still learning about. You know, we're looking at, now everyone's going back and looking at their own population, and we're gaining experiences with these tests. I think, and realistically, what I see in our practice, we have about 12 to 15% of patients with gastric cancer positive and about 15 to 20% of patients with GE junction adenocarcinomas positive. So it's not as high as the TOGA trial might suggest. They had a little bit more loose criteria than what we use nowadays. You know, they looked at any FISH positive tumor as eligible. And I think the tumors that really have shown to respond even in TOGA were the IHC immunohistochemistry 3+, and the IHC 2+ and FISH plus tumors. So this is not as large population as suggested in the TOGA trial initially.
Yeah, although I thought that they had 20%. I mean, in any event, 20% is breast cancer.
Yeah, but breast cancer is a much more common disease. And gastric cancer is dying out. But I agree with you. I mean, and even if you talk about lung cancer and you have this ALK ELM4 mutation fusion protein and it's 3%, you know, so we are in the era now where we have to rely on subgroups. And, you know, if we had a BRAF inhibitor that really worked in colon cancer affecting only 7% of patients, I would be very happy.
So what happened with this patient?
So this patient started on EOX. We tested for HER2. He was found to be HER2 3+ positive, so strongly overexpressing. Actually, the pathologist called me about this because one of the strongest overexpression we had seen so far. And so when he came back after 3 weeks for a second cycle, I talked to him about this and we said, you know, based on the data, I would actually suggest to throw out the anthracycline epirubicin and introduce a trastuzumab for various reasons. I mean, you don't want anthracycline and trastuzumab in one regimen, you know, because of the potential cardiotoxicity. Number two, I think, you know, epirubicin is probably the most dispensable component of this treatment. So we created a HOX regimen, or I don't know, TOX or TOC regimen, whatever you want, because he had tolerated the oxaliplatin and capecitabine component very well. We continued the treatment for a total of 3 cycles overall, no treatment delays, no myelosuppression, very mild hand-foot syndrome. At that time, no neurotoxicity from oxaliplatin. And we did a scan on kind of end of March, and he had a very dramatic response. I mean, his liver metastasis, actually his dysphagia was completely gone even after the first 2 weeks of therapy, which also indicates he started to respond before trastuzumab was on board. But I personally have never seen a response like what he had with conventional chemotherapy, because we continued the treatment for another 3 cycles, did a scan on June 25th this year. And I mean, our radiologist now called me and said, you know, what are you doing to this patient? So he had, I mean, some of the large metastases that you actually see in front of you were gone, you know, were calcified. He was doing extremely well. And it's a pretty dramatic response. I mean, I've never seen anything like it in the era of just chemotherapy.
So what are you going to do, you're thinking, as you move forward in terms of what are you going to continue and for how long?
Yeah, so he had, after six cycles of this oxaliplatin-based regimen, we were talking about oxaliplatin 130 milligrams per meter squared, he did develop neurotoxicity now. And so in analogy to what I do in colon cancer, I mean, we cannot continue oxaliplatin indefinitely in these palliative patients. So I talked to him about stopping oxaliplatin and continue with the rest. I mean, he's tolerated capecitabine, trastuzumab very well. In fact, in the TOGA trial, patients could continue trastuzumab until progression. I mean, they had a fixed schedule of six cycles of cisplatin 5-FU or capecitabine plus trastuzumab, and then they continued trastuzumab until progression. And I actually follow a similar regimen here. We'll continue capecitabine trastuzumab and delete oxaliplatin. He's in this first cycle of this, whatever you call it, maintenance therapy or continued therapy approach. We'll see whether this is able to keep the tumor controlled.
So let's talk about your second patient, the 68-year-old woman with first the stage 2 colon cancer and then a second primary tumor in the rectum.
Now, that's a patient I actually saw just about 2 days ago. She had a history of cervical cancer in 1995, was treated with surgery and radiation therapy because, you know, later she developed a rectal cancer, which influenced our decision of how to proceed there. In September of 2008, she developed abdominal discomfort, was diagnosed with a cecal mass, colonoscopy showed an adenocarcinoma, staging did not show any signs of metastasis. She had laparoscopic surgery for what turned out to be a stage 2 colon cancer, PT3, N0, so 34 lymph nodes were negative. So clearly a kind of a low-risk stage 2 colon cancer. She was enrolled in ECOG E5202, which is a national endeavor to look for, let's say, in stage 2 patients for molecular stratification in terms of molecular high-risk markers, mainly using MSI, you know, the microsatellite instability, in LOH18Q, which is loss of heterozygosity of the 18Q chromosome. And she was considered low risk. She was MSI high, actually. So clearly not a reason for her to receive any therapy and was enrolled in the observation arm. And these patients get followed. I mean, they get their scans, they get their colonoscopies, etc. In fall of 2009, she had a colonoscopy. Everything was fine. And in April this year, she actually developed left abdominal pain, had blood per rectum, and was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma in her midrectum per colonoscopy, which to me was surprising. I mean, we had a colonoscopy which was negative in fall of 2009, and now just a little bit more than half a year later, she had an adenocarcinoma, which actually quite locally advanced. Her EUS criteria was a T3 N+. We did a biopsy of lymph nodes, so she had lymph node positive disease in her rectum. And now the question was, you know, how to proceed from here. Standard of care would have been neoadjuvant radio chemotherapy, but she had had her cervical cancer before, so we could not use radiation therapy. So we used the approach which was presented at ASCO GI from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Group and ASCO this year by Deb Schrag, again, using neoadjuvant FOLFOX.
So it's the same thing we just talked about.
It's the same thing we just talked about. I mean, this was kind of out of a necessity because we couldn't really use any radiation therapy here. She had three cycles pre-op, had good tolerability. It's actually interesting because I thought this tumor is quite aggressive. You know, it had a very short time until it occurred. You know, trusting the colonoscopy in fall of 2009 was well done. So I really wanted this patient to have chemotherapy as soon as possible and, you know, testing the effectiveness of this chemotherapy. She underwent an APR. Unfortunately, she had to have an APR in June. It turned out to be a T3N0 tumor. I mean, again, we had prior biopsy confirmation of lymph node involvement. 14 lymph nodes were negative. Two had kind of signs of prior tumor manifestation, now necrotic, so no viable tumor. It was considered T3N0. And now I just saw her this week, and we plan continuation of chemotherapy with a sandwich approach now, another 9 cycles of FOLFOX if she tolerates it.
So do you think that the reason that she had no lymph nodes pathologically, but she had them on ultrasound, was tumor response?
Yes. I mean, otherwise, I mean, she had biopsy-proven lymph node involvement before, and now on a close examination of the resected specimen, lymph nodes were gone, so she definitely had a treatment effect, which is reassuring for me to continue the same treatment. I mean, the question is, what do you do if you see no response whatsoever after neoadjuvant therapy? I mean, most of us would still continue treatment to some extent because we have no alternative. If we had alternatives, we'd probably switch. You know, that's something we do when we look at sarcomas, for instance. You look at mitotic indices and the necrosis you induce with chemotherapy, and you might switch chemotherapy later on after resection. But here, nowadays, we have no alternative to 5-FU-oxaplatin-based regimen or capecitabine oxaplatin.
So one final question about this case, sort of looking back, of course, there's no way to really know, but do you think that the radiation therapy for the cervical cancer was in some way related to her developing both of these GI cancers?
Could be. I mean, cecum and rectum are probably within the radiation field of pelvic radiation. And we know that prior radiation, for instance, patients with prostate cancer radiation have a higher risk for the development of rectal cancer. And I actually discussed that with her because she asked that same question. And yes, could be. Question is, you know, what does it add to the way we proceed from here? It complicated things. And it's an interesting point. Unfortunately, you know, that's just something we had to deal with.
So let's talk about your 50-year-old man with liver-only mets.
Now that's, again, a patient which I consider quite interesting in the sense that he was initially diagnosed actually traveling with his wife for an appointment here at Mayo Clinic. He's from the Middle East and had abdominal discomfort, went to the ER, eventually was found to have a colon cancer, a sigmoid cancer, which was almost obstructing in December of 2007, and underwent resection, sigmoid resection staging at that point did not show any metastatic disease. And it turned out to be a T3N2B tumor, according to newer classification, with 25 of 30 lymph nodes positive. I mean, that's a big flag, you know, 25 out of 30 lymph nodes positive. We have checked for MSI status. He was MSS. I mean, it's a left-sided colon, 48-year-old patient. But he did not have any signs of, let's say, HNPCC Lynch syndrome predisposition. From the Middle East, as I said, he opted to stay here for the whole duration of adjuvant therapy. And so we started modified FOLFOX6 as one of our standards of care. And the problem was he had elevation of his liver function test. His AST went over 200. And we see this sometimes with oxaplatin, actually more than with 5-FU. So we held oxaplatin after 6 cycles, but the LFTs actually went up further. In the end, we actually stopped 5-FU leucovorin after 8-9 cycles and decided to observe him. He had a history of fluctuating liver enzymes before, so there's some underlying liver disease, which I haven't really pinpointed yet, but eventually when we stopped therapy, we kind of worked him up. There was no evidence of any metastatic disease. So then he actually came back. He flew back from the Middle East in regular intervals, missed his appointment, though, in January this year, and came in July, actually earlier this week, when I saw him. And he was used to having good news, you know, all the time. It's more like a casual, friendly, social visit. And then I had to tell him, you know, your CT scan now shows a 2.5 centimeter mass in your right lobe, the dome of the right lobe. No CA elevation, but PET positive. And for him, this was definitely a blow because he didn't expect that. You know, everything had been fine. For me, it wasn't that much of a surprise. I mean, he had a high-risk tumor, 25 of 30 lymph nodes, not perfectly aligned chemotherapy afterwards because of the liver toxicity we saw. I was actually intrigued to see that it took so long for the tumor to come back, you know, this high-risk scenario, and with only one metastasis, solitary metastasis, indicating to me to some extent, you know, the treatment probably worked. Because in this bad prognosis scenario, we still have a potentially curable situation because, you know, that's our goal right now. We're targeting this patient in a curative sense. So then I discussed with our surgeons here and with the patient, you know, should we use a neoadjuvant chemotherapy approach, meaning using chemotherapy to see chemosensitivity of this metastasis, or should we go for surgery right away? And normally I tend toward neoadjuvant strategies more than postoperative strategies based on the fact that, you know, we gain some biologic information about the tumor, chemosensitivity testing, etc. We know that this treatment normally does not interfere with the surgery if you don't do it too long, if you don't inflict liver injury. And this is the case here. You know, the concern that I have now, if we give chemotherapy, what if the patient develops a chemical hepatitis, liver enzymes elevation, and then the surgeon tells me, you know, we need to wait and we need to have this calm down. So in this very specific scenario, I actually opted for the patient to go to surgery right away, discuss it with him, discuss with our liver surgeon. He's actually in surgery at this moment, very moment as we speak.
Wow.
He was seen yesterday and by our surgeon. He's going through surgery at this moment. I'll see him after our interview. And hopefully everything's fine. We'll perform an interruptive ultrasound. We have standby radio frequency ablation, which is one of the standard procedures. If we saw, let's say, small lesions somewhere in the left lobe, we wouldn't sacrifice a lot more liver. We'd actually perform an intraoperative radio frequency ablation. And yeah, then we'll discuss postoperative adjuvant therapy.
So just to clarify, in general, in patients who present with isolated, easily resectable disease, I realize this man was a little bit different. In general, you're leaning towards pre-op treatment, and if so, why?
To kind of backpedal on that a little bit, it depends on when these tumors occur. I mean, if you have a synchronous lesion, let's say a patient presents as a stage 4 tumor with a solitary lesion, I think it's important to use neoadjuvant therapy, even if the tumor is resectable, because, you know, we have one snapshot of this tumor biology. What if we waited 2 or 3 months? Would we see 4 or 5 metastases? I think it's very important to, in a synchronous metastatic settings, patient presents with stage 4 disease, to use neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So in a patient where it takes a longer time, beyond 2 years, let's say 3 years, to develop metastasis, solitary metastasis, the situation might be different. So we might actually opt for surgery followed by chemotherapy adjuvant setting because the tumor biology is different and we have a lot more information about this patient. So anything in between is up for grabs, is up for kind of a decision and opted for one way or the other, more leaning toward neoadjuvant therapy, again, to gain biological information on the tumor. Does the tumor respond well? I've had one patient where I actually used FOLFOX, for instance, neoadjuvant therapy. The tumor progressed. One of those 10% of patients who did not respond to FOLFOX, at least with stable disease. And we actually switched to an irinotecan-based regimen, and the tumor responded well, and used this as rational to later use irinotecan-based regimen as post-operative therapy. Whether that's right or wrong, you know, I don't know. So I think it is one of those questions which is up in the air, realistically. And there is actually a study that is going to be run, or it's being opened as we speak, by NSABP, C11, which will test the question of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, kind of a sandwich approach like the ERTC trial, FOLFOX, bevacizumab in this case, before surgery and after surgery, or just surgery followed by postoperative FOLFOX bevacizumab, which remains to be seen whether this is eventually going to give us the answer.
Let's talk briefly about your 44-year-old woman with pancreatic cancer. It looks like it was a pretty complicated case. Maybe you can sort of just briefly overview it and maybe focus more on where she is right now.
So this is a 44-year-old patient who was diagnosed with metastatic pancreatic cancer in 2008. Actually, she was 42 at that point. Healthy, lean, mother of 2 kids, very young appearing. So it was a diagnosis that really shocked her. She had a large, initially unresectable cancer in the head of her pancreas, had biliary obstruction, and a clearly biopsy-proven and PET-positive metastasis in her liver. The critical issue here was we started her at that time what we thought of standard of care, a gemcitabine-based regimen. We added capecitabine to it because, you know, just to make this treatment more active. Young patient, healthy, no comorbidities. And she responded extremely well, one of the best responses I've ever seen. So the tumor in her pancreas shrunk. I mean, it was resectable finally. And so what do you do with that? This tumor biologically did not behave like a normal garden variety pancreatic cancer. And so we actually opted to go after the metastasis. So she underwent a laparoscopic Whipple procedure plus laparoscopic liver resection, and was free of disease after about half a year. And we continued gemcitabine, capecitabine for some time, then staged her again. She had no evidence of metastatic disease. So eventually we just decided to consolidate the local tumor control by radiation therapy and eventually take her off therapy. She was off therapy for about half a year and then had tumor recurrence in her liver. We started her again of capecitabine gem, had another tumor response, not as long lasting, as before they developed retroperitoneal lymph node metastasis. And then she went to Dr. Von Hoff, you know, at TGen. They have this molecular marker testing, which is called Target Now, which is one of those actually very interesting, but probably a little bit premature in terms of, you know, the evidence level you generate. And based on the molecular marker profile, I was informed that the tumor would likely respond to imatinib, irinotecan.
Whoa. Wow.
And I think topotecan it was, which is not necessarily what I would normally use in pancreatic cancer. And 5-FU, actually, which was clear. I mean, the patient had responded, actually, to capecitabine to some degree. So when she came back, one of the, at that time, already kind of the rumors about FOLFIRINOX were already circulating, you know, and I think this is a very interesting topic for this patient or a similar patient in this scenario. So we actually started her on FOLFIRI based on the kind of FOLFIRINOX data which were presented at ASCO 2010, and tumor response wasn't that great. I mean, she actually had more back pain when I saw her.
Just out of curiosity, no imatinib, huh?
No imatinib. It's kind of stretching a little bit in my eyes. There are a lot of tumors that are c-KIT positive,
sure,
but not a lot of tumors are driven by c-KIT. I mean, that
right.
is the GIST thing, you know. And this,
right.
I remember when GIST and c-KIT came about, there were a lot of tumors where we saw c-KIT overexpression, and we used imatinib in a lot of tumors. But that's not what it is. That's not driving the biology for most tumors. That's really unique to GIST, at least for now. And so now she's actually switched to FOLFOX, which I think is one of the standards of second-line therapy. She's in a third-line situation right now based on a German phase 3 trial showing survival benefit for the use of oxaplatin. If I had a patient like her, again, let's say tomorrow or let's say next week, I would not use gemcitabine anymore as my standard of care. And a young patient where her biliary obstruction was controlled, she had no comorbidities, I think the standard of care nowadays would be to use something like FOLFIRINOX.
What about nab-paclitaxel? Dr. Van Hoff's done some interesting work on that. Is that something you're thinking about for her?
Yes, that's something I have in the back of my mind to use in a Abraxane-like treatment, so these nanoparticles. You know, she was tested for SPARC, actually, and she did not express SPARC, so it's not necessarily something that I would use as my first choice. But again, when you're backed against the wall, you do a lot of things.
What did you think about that data set and where it might be heading?
I mean, the phase 3 trials are ongoing, or I think almost completed accrual, and so we'll probably see more data within a year, because, you know, that's the short timelines in pancreatic cancer. The problem will be, and, you know, because the comparator arm here was gemcitabine. How relevant is gemcitabine still as comparator arm if you now have, at least in good performance status, normal bilirubin patients, a treatment, a triple combination therapy, 5-FU and oxaplatin, which generates a survival of 11.1 months in a phase 3 trial? So that's actually a problem that we see we have to face right now for future drug approval. I mean, the FDA regulatory standard is gemcitabine. Gemcitabine erlotinib, if you want. But in clinical practice, I can see that at least those patients with good performance status, younger, no comorbidities, which are the patients you want in a registration trial, those patients would be probably more candidates for FOLFIRINOX.
Although, I mean, I've heard a lot of people hesitate a little bit about using FOLFIRINOX in terms of toxicity, particularly with the older patient.
Correct. And that's why, I mean, we have a hard time embracing these data as standard of care for the garden variety pancreatic cancer. Again, if I had this patient, a 40-year-old, early 40-year-old patient, no comorbidities, it would be hard for me not to give FOLFIRINOX. And what we've done at Mayo Clinic, we discussed this internally. We will use FOLFIRINOX for these patients. And we will document everything we're doing. We'll closely follow the outcome and see, before we have the results of, let's say, or any initiated trials in the United States, because I think it needs to be confirmed, we will document our experiences and see whether it's as easy to manage as the French group actually says. You know, the problem, Neil, that I have with our approach in pancreatic cancer is that we had this mindset of it's a very bad disease, patients will die within a very short time, we should do no harm. We use gemcitabine, which is easy to tolerate, doesn't create a lot of problems. And I don't know whether it's the right approach anymore, because, I mean, perhaps we should have said, you know, this is a very aggressive disease, and in patients who can tolerate aggressive therapy, we need aggressive treatment, we need a triple combination therapy. You know, there is this GTX therapy around gemcitabine, docetaxel capecitabine, which at least in single institution setting as a triple therapy generated amazing responses and survival data, which hasn't really been confirmed in randomized trials. But, you know, it might be that our approach, one size fits all, gemcitabine for all patients, whether they're young or old, and we're in a palliative setting, palliative mindset, might be the wrong one. And I'm actually intrigued by seeing that we've moved this along. The problem that I see is FOLFIRINOX will likely not be a good platform to add another biologic agent to it because it's too toxic to begin with. I have a hard time seeing that we can add a, let's say, hedgehog inhibitor, a taxane, whatever to it, which it's very difficult to use this as a platform to develop further drugs. But I think it kind of opened the door for non-gemcitabine-based treatment approaches, which I'm very happy about because I strongly believe that the strategy we had before, gemcitabine plus X, you know, as a new trial approach, was wrong and has really stalled the advances in pancreatic cancer. We have been using this approach, gem versus gem plus X, for more than 15 years, and we haven't really moved pancreatic cancer at all.
One final question. Now, this woman had her primary and a couple of liver mets resected at the same time. Do you ever send patients for resection of liver mets alone? Well, we were talking about that before with colon cancer and pancreatic cancer.
You know, in pancreatic cancer, normally not. I mean, I do believe, however, that when you assess the situation, whether you should perform, when you go after metastasis in other tumors beyond colon cancer, where we do it routinely, you normally look at the biology of the tumors. I mean, and I remember I had a patient years ago with ovarian cancer, and this patient had one liver metastasis, which responded to therapy, always came back. And we kind of did this chemotherapy-controlled cycle through various chemotherapies for about 2 years. And eventually the metastasis grew, she had biliary obstruction, etc., and died. And in retrospect, I should have taken this metastasis out. So going after metastasis is not just a thing for colon cancer. There are select patients. I think everyone oncologist you talk to has done it once in a while in breast cancer, in lung cancer, in colon cancer, of course. And perhaps even in select patients with aggressive tumor like pancreatic cancer that responded very well, had a different biology than normal pancreatic cancers. I think surgery can be part of our treatment strategy, even for a medical oncologist.